Issa, Sufi, the People of the Past, Volume 2. Talks on Sufism given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. Why did one go kill himself? Why did Hemingway put a shotgun in his mouth and blow the top of his head off? Why do they poison their rivers, their air, and their own food? Why do they justify it all with their reasoning, psychology, and logic? Why do they come here for a couple of months, and why do you have so much compassion for them? I'm sick and tired of them. The question is from Prajit. First, there are suicides and suicides. Each suicide has something unique in it, as each life has something unique in it. Your life is yours, and your death is also going to be yours. Sometimes it is possible your life may not be yours, but it is not possible that your death may not be yours. A life can be anonymous. You live with others. You can compromise too much. You can imitate. But death is always unique, because death is alone. You die alone. There is no society. They don't exist in your death. The crowd, the mass is there when you are alive. But when you die absolutely alone, utterly alone. Death has a quality. So sometimes it happens, a man may commit suicide because he has become tired of the anonymous existence. He has become tired of all the compromises that one has to make in order to live. That's why Van Gogh committed suicide. He was a rare man. One of the greatest painters ever. But he had to make compromises every moment of his life. He got tired of those compromises. He could not tolerate anymore to be part of the crowd mind. He killed himself in order to be himself. He was only 33 or something when he killed himself. If he had been in the East, there was another alternative. Suicide or sannyas. These are the two alternatives, which every man who has some sense of life, individuality, has to choose between these two alternatives. In the West, nothing like sannyas has been in existence. If you become a Christian monk, that is again a compromise. You still remain part of the society. Even if you go out of the society, you remain part of it. The society goes on controlling you. It has a remote control system. it does not allow you really to go out of it. You remain a Christian, you remain a Catholic, even while you have moved to a monastery. It does not make much difference. In the East, sannyas has a totally different flavor. The moment you become a sannyasin, you are no more a Hindu, you are no more a Mohammedan, you are no more a Christian. The moment you become a sannyasin, you drop out of all collectivities. You become yourself. You will be surprised to know that in the East people don't commit so much suicide as in the West. And the difference is big. Too big to be just accidental. In the East, we have created a creative kind of suicide, that is sannyas. You can still live, and you can live in your own way. Then the need to suicide disappears, or becomes very, very less. In the West, it always has happened that the unique individuals had to commit suicide. The mediocres go on living. The unique has to commit suicide. A Van Gogh, a Hemingway, a Mayakovsky. These are unique individuals. A Nijinsky. Either they have to commit suicide or they have to go mad. The society drives them mad. The society puts so much pressure on them that either they have to yield to the society and become just anonymous, or they have to go mad, or they have to commit suicide, and all are destructive alternatives. Nietzsche went mad. That was his way of committing suicide. Nijinsky committed suicide, that is his way of going mad. Nietzsche had the same quality as a Buddha. Had he been in the East, he would have become a Buddha. But the West does not give the alternative at all. He had to go mad. Van Gogh also has a unique quality of tremendous intelligence, creativity. He could have moved on the path of sannyas and samadhi. But there was no door open. He got tired. Just going on living with compromise was hurting too much. It was not worth. One day he completed his painting, the painting that he always wanted to do. And that day he felt, now there is no need to make any compromise with anybody for any reason. I have done my paintings. I have done my best. It is time to disappear. He always wanted to paint a sunrise. He has been painting sunrise for years, but still something was missing and lacking, and he will paint again and again. The day his painting was complete, and he was fulfilled and satisfied and contented that it has happened, that very moment, it was absolutely clear for him that now there is no need. I was waiting only for this painting. I am fulfilled in it. I have bloomed. Now why make compromises? For what? He committed suicide. He was not mad. He was simply not mediocre. His suicide is not a crime. His suicide is simply a condemnation of your so-called society, which asks for so many compromises. Mediocre people are ready. they have nothing to lose. In fact, they feel very good being part of a crowd, of a mob. Because in the crowd, they need not think about themselves as mediocre. All are just like them. They can lose themselves in the crowd. They can lose themselves and forget themselves with the mass mind. And in the mass mind, they have no responsibility. They need not bother whether they are intelligent, unintelligent. They need not bother whether they are asleep or awakened. But a man who has some soul in him will find it continuously heavy to go on degrading himself, to go on compromising for small, ordinary, trivial, meaningless things. For bread and butter, for a house, a shelter, for clothes. Van Gogh was very poor because his paintings won't sell. His paintings were at least 100 years ahead of his time. They are always so. Greater the intelligence, bigger is the distance between the people that exist by his side and the people for whom his painting, his poetry, his assertions will be meaningful. He comes before his time. That's why Buddha's assertions are still relevant, still fresh. Not rotten, not old. His time is coming now as if he came 2500 years before his time. Vincent van Gogh's paintings are becoming now great paintings. Great appreciation has arisen for him. He came a little earlier. They always come. His brother used to give him money enough just to keep his body and soul together because his paintings won't sell. So just enough money. And Van Gogh will eat half the week and half the week he will fast to save money to paint. Just think how difficult it was for him to live. And nobody will appreciate his painting. Once it happens, his brother arranged. He told a friend that you go and at least purchase one painting. At least once in life you should have the joy that somebody has purchased his painting. You take money from me, go and purchase a painting. The friend went. Van Gogh was very happy. This was the first man who has come to appreciate. But soon he recognized the facts. Because the man was not interested and Van Gogh was thrilled and dancing. And he was showing his paintings, all the paintings that he had done. And the man was not interested, he was just fulfilling a duty. He said, any will do. You just give me any painting and take this money. It hurt him even more. He threw the man out with his money. And he said, I suspect it is my brother behind it. He always wanted somebody to purchase and it seems he has sent you. Get out from here and I am not going to sell. I wanted somebody to love my painting, to see what I have done. But you are not the person, you don't have any perception. You don't have any aesthetic sense.
You don't know what paintings mean. You simply get out. So not a single painting was sold. Starving, fasting, he was painting 3 days, 4 days, and for 3-4 days he will be able to eat. The day he completed his painting that he always wanted to complete, he was in mad love with the sun. Sun is the source of life. Maybe sun was his symbol for God. Maybe through the sun he was searching God. The day he painted his sunrise, he committed suicide. This suicide is not a crime. It is simply a shout against the mediocre society that we have created in the world. It is simply a protest that this society is not worth living for those who have life, and this society is only for mediocre. This society is only for those who really don't want to love, just want to drag. But each society will have a different quality to it. You ask, why did Hemingway commit suicide? Hemingway's society has another flavor, different from Van Gogh. Hemingway's whole search was the search for freedom. Now, birth has happened. It was not your choice. You have been thrown in life, as the existentialists say. You have been thrown. It has not been your choice. Nobody has ever asked you whether you want to be born or not. So birth is not freedom. That has already happened. Now the next most important thing is love. But that is also not possible to do. When it happens, it happens. You cannot manage. You cannot will it. If you want to love a person just through will, it is impossible. It happens, then it happens. Suddenly you are in love. That's why we use the phrase falling in love. You fall into it. But you cannot will it. It comes from the unknown. It is just like birth again. As if God manages that you fall in love with this person. As if the decision comes from the blue. You are not the decisive factor. You are more like a victim. You cannot do anything against it. If it happens, you have to go for it. If it does not happen, you can do whatever you want to do and it will not happen. Nobody can produce love on orders. And three things are important in life. The most important: birth, love, death. Death is the only thing that you can do something about. You can commit suicide. Hemingway's search was for freedom. He wanted to do something that he has done. Birth he has not managed. Love he has not managed. Now only death. Only one thing is there, which if you want to do, you can do. It will be your act, individual, done by you. Death has a mysterious quality about it. A very strange paradox. If you are standing by the side of a small baby, just born, and somebody asks you to say something absolutely certain about the baby, the baby is in his crib, asleep, relaxing. What can you say absolutely certainly about the baby? Only one thing, that he will die. This is very strange to say. Anything else is uncertain. He may love, he may not love. He may succeed, he may fail. He may be a sinner, he may be a saint. All maybes. But nothing certain about anything. Nothing possible to predict. Only one thing you can say, which looks very absurd at the side of a baby who has just been born. That only one thing is absolutely certain, that he will die. This prediction can be made. And your prediction is never going to be wrong. So death has a certain quality of certainty about it, one thing, that it is going to happen. And at the same time has something absolutely uncertain about it too. One never knows when it is going to happen. Certainty that it is going to happen. Uncertainty about when it is going to happen. Certainty and uncertainty both about death make it a mystery, a paradox. If you go on living, it will happen. But then again it will be from the below. You will not be the decisive factor. Birth happened, love happened, and death also happened. That made Hemingway uneasy. He wanted to do at least one thing in life on which he can have his own signature. He can say that this I did. That's why he committed suicide. Suicide was an exercise in freedom. You cannot know anything about death unless you go into it. Hemingway's attitude is that if it is going to happen, then why be dragged into it? Why not go into it on your own? It is going to happen. His whole life's concern was death. That's why he became so much interested in bullfights. Death was very close by. He was constantly attracted by the theme of death, what it is. But you cannot know. Even somebody is dying in front of you, you don't know anything about death. You simply know that the breathing has disappeared, that this man's eyes won't open again, that this man will never speak again, that his heart is no more beating. That's all, but this is nothing. How do you know about death by these things? The mystery remains mystery. You have not even touched it. You can know it only by going into it. But if you are dragged, then more possibilities are there that you will become unconscious because you will be dragged. Almost always, people die unconsciously. Before death happens, they become so afraid. So much afraid that a kind of coma surrounds them and protects them. It is a natural anesthesia. Just as you go for an operation, you need anesthesia. And that is the greatest operation there is. The soul and body will be torn apart. So nature has some built-in mechanism. Before you start dying, you go into a coma. All consciousness disappears. In the first place, it was not very much, even while you were alive. It was just a tiny flicker. When the wind of death comes, that flicker is gone. There is complete darkness. Hemingway wanted to go into death fully conscious. It was a conscious exercise in dying. But that is possible only either through suicide or through samadhi. These are the only two possibilities. You can die consciously only in two ways. Either you commit suicide, manage your own death, have your revolver ready, contemplate over it, put your revolver on your chest or on your head, pull the trigger yourself consciously, see the explosion and see death. This is one possibility, very destructive possibility. Another possibility is go more and more in meditation, attain to a state of awareness that cannot be drowned by death. Then there is no need to commit suicide. Then whenever death comes, let it come. You will be dying fully alert, aware, watchful. So suicide or sannyas, suicide or samadhi. And in the West, sannyas and samadhi have not been available. That's why these two very rare people committed suicide, and they have not been understood. People think they are kind of ill, neurotic, mad, morbid, unhealthy. They are not. And I am not saying that all people who commit suicide are the same, that they are neurotic people who will commit suicide. There are morbid people who are more concerned with death than they are concerned with life, who enjoy destructiveness. There are self-destructive mechanisms who go on poisoning themselves. I'm not talking about all suicides, but you have asked about these two. And there are as many as people commit suicide, but these two are very rare. These two are very potential. If Vincent van Gogh or Hemingway had been in the East or had the Eastern attitude, they would have flowers as great sannyasins. And then you ask, why do they poison their rivers, their air and their own food? That is again a kind of creating a mass society very slowly. When you live unintelligently, insensitively, you live such a dull kind of life that your interest naturally starts moving towards death. That's why there are constant wars. And the periods that you call days of peace are not much concerned with peace. They are only preparations for a new war. So either you are in war or you prepare for war. There are only two kinds of periods in history: actual fighting and preparation for the fighting. There had never been a period of peace. The peace is absolutely false, pretentious. Underneath the peace, underground, you are preparing for another war. Why so much attraction for war? Because only when people are dying, you become a little alert. When there is danger, you become a little alert. You don't know how to be alert in any other way. That's why when there is war, you will see people's faces more alive. Something is happening. Otherwise, nothing happens. It is the same old tale told by an idiot full of fury and knife, signifying nothing. Every day you get up and the same life starts. are the same ruts. Every night you go to bed and you have ended again another repetition of a day. And you can be certain that tomorrow again you will do the same. When war happens, things are no more routine. There is suddenly news in the air. Something new is happening. So people are destructive. They create war. And they create many kinds of war. They have been constantly fighting with nature, and nature is our life. Nature is our very source. But even a man like Bertrand Russell writes a book with the title Conquest of Nature. Conquest, the very idea is aggressive. As if we are against nature, or nature is against us. We are one. We are nature. The trees are nature and people are not nature. The air is nature and the sun and moon are nature, and the eyes and the smiles and the tears are not nature. Just as the earth goes on growing into trees, it goes on growing into people too. It is the same nature. It is the same ecology. It is one whole. And it is interdependent. And everything depends on everything else. But the Western mind has been very aggressive. Nature has to be conquered. You have to fight amongst yourself. You have to fight with nature. Not only that, you have to fight with yourself. These are the three fights. Man fights with other men. Man fights with nature. Man fights with himself. When man fights with other men, it is politics. When man fights with nature, it is science. And when man fights with himself, it is religion. This is a foolish kind of approach. As if the whole thing depends on fighting. Whom do you call the religious man? One who fights with himself. Continuously repressing, cutting his life into fragments, choosing, judging, destroying, becoming split and schizophrenic. This is the same attitude, aggressive, violent attitude. It shows in politics because it is the same man. It shows in religion because it is the same man. It shows what you do with nature. You ask me, why do they poison their rivers, their air and their own food? Because they are poisons with violence. So whatsoever they do becomes poisonous. They are suicidal because they don't know what life is and they don't know how to live it. They don't know the joy and the celebration. They don't know that it is a gift, that it is a great gift. They don't know the gratitude. So they go on being destructive in every possible way. The Western attitude has been growing more and more towards death and is bringing death to this planet every day closer. Any day this planet can explode into utter annihilation. The whole intelligence, technology, science, politics, everything is directing towards one thing: how to commit a global suicide. But it is the same man. I would like you to become just the contrary, the man who loves and not fights, the man who loves himself. That's why my religion is a love for yourself. And the man who loves himself loves others. then there will be a totally different kind of politics. It will be based in love. And the man who loves himself and loves other people loves nature too. Because trees are people, birds are people, animals are people. Then there will be a different kind of science in the world. But the change has to come from religion, because religion is the deepest cause. Because you hate yourself, that's why you hate others, that's why you hate nature. Those are just reverberations of the original hate that you go on carrying with yourself. Why do they justify it all with their reasoning, psychology and love? What else they can do? One has to justify everything. In fact, when you are doing something wrong, you have to justify it immediately. Otherwise, you will yourself become aware of the wrong that you have done. And you will be a criminal in your own eyes. To avoid that, you have to find rationalizations. Once a scientist was staying with me, and I love my garden to be a jungle. So I had a beautiful jungle around my house. The scientist said to me, "Are you aware what are you doing? If you allow these trees to grow so close to the house, they will run over the house. These are dangerous things. There is a constant fight between men and trees," he said. "If you don't keep them away, within years, their roots will enter into your walls and they will destroy your house." He said, "I hate trees." That has been the attitude of men. Destroy. You can take that attitude, then everything becomes inimical. Even poor trees, innocent trees. And there is some fact in it, so you can base your reasoning on it. Yes, this is true. That if trees are left to grow completely in freedom, then they will run over your towns and your houses. That's true. It is factual. But to base your whole life on that small fact and make it a philosophy is wrong. The other thing is, as much fact as this, that we exist with the trees, destroy all the trees and we will die. You breathe oxygen in. Trees exhale oxygen. You exhale carbon dioxide. Trees inhale carbon dioxide. So when you are surrounded by trees, you are more alive. It is not just poetry. When you go into a jungle and a great jubilation comes to your heart, you suddenly feel more alive, as if the greenery makes you also green. It is not just poetry. It is pure science. Because there is more oxygen, more life throbbing all around, more vitality. And when you breathe that oxygen in, your blood is purified. You can throw the toxins more easily. And you live at the maximum. So there is a partnership with the trees. They take your poison in and purify it and create oxygen for you. You take oxygen in. You use the oxygen and throw the carbon dioxide outside. Trees use carbon dioxide as their food. So there is an absolute partnership Man cannot live without trees, and trees cannot live without man. Animals are needed for trees, and trees are needed for animals. They are not separate. They are part of one rhythm. This too is a fact, and life should not avoid this. One has to understand the totality of it. And one has to live in such a way that no one fact becomes or pretends to become the whole. There is no need to destroy. There is no need to fight. That is the approach of Tao, the approach of Sufism, Zen. There is a famous Zen story. A king asked his old carpenter that I would like a certain table for me. The old man said, I am very old and my son is yet not ready. He is learning by and by. But I will try. I will do my best. Give me time. For 3 days the old man disappeared in the forest. After 3 days he came back. The king asked, it takes 3 days to bring little wood for the table? The old carpenter said, sometimes 3 days, sometimes 3 months, and sometimes you may not find for 3 years. It is a difficult art. The king was puzzled. He said, you explain it. What do you mean? Say in detail. And the man said, first I have to go on a fast. Because only when I am a fast, by and by my mind slows down. When my mind slows down, all aggression disappears. Then I am no more violent. Because all thoughts disappear. There is pure compassion and love, a different vibe. When I feel that vibe of no mind, then I go into the forest, because only through that I can find the right tree. Otherwise, with aggression, how can you find the right tree? And I have to ask the trees themselves whether they are willing to become a table. Whether some tree is willing to become a table? I go, I look around, and when I feel that this tree is willing. But that willing can be felt only when I have no mind. So fasting, meditating, when I become absolutely empty, I simply roam around with the trees to have a feel. When I feel that this tree fits, I sit by the side of the tree, ask the permission of the tree that I am going to cut a branch from you. Are you willing? If the tree says yes, wholeheartedly, only then I cut. Otherwise, who am I? Now, this is a totally different approach. There is no fight between the man and the tree. There is a friendship. The man tries to fall and rapport with the trees. Ask their permission. This is absurd for a Western mind. The Western mind says, what nonsense are you talking about? Asking a tree? Have you gone crazy? And how the tree can say yes or no? But now, even Western science is by and by becoming aware of it, that the tree can say yes or no. Now, sophisticated instruments exist, which can detect the moods of a tree, whether the tree is willing, whether the tree is unwilling, whether the tree is happy or unhappy. Now, certain instruments have been developed. Just like cardiogram, you can have a cardiogram of the tree. Electronic instruments which detect the moods of the tree. When a woodcutter comes around the tree is shaken with fear, is sad, is afraid, clings to her life. No Taoist will cut a tree in that state. No, not at all. The tree is not willing, and we, who we are. When the tree on its own is ready to share, then only. Now this table will have a different quality to it. It has been a gift from the tree. It has not been taken away. It has not been robbed. It has not been conquered. Now it will be difficult to understand that this table will have a different vibe to it. It will have something sacred about it. If you put this table in your room, you will create a certain kind of a space around the table, which will not be possible for other tables. It will be there befriending you because you befriended it. It will be there, part of your family, not a limb cut from an enemy. But the Western mind has been too aggressive against itself, and it has created schizophrenia against people, and it has created politics, wars, and against nature, and it has created the ecological crisis. But things have gone now to the extreme. Either man has to turn back and drop the Western aggressive attitudes, or man has to get ready to say goodbye to this planet. This planet cannot tolerate you anymore. It has tolerated you already enough. Why do they come here for a couple of months, and why do you have so much compassion for them? They need compassion. Because only through compassion they will learn compassion. There is no other way to learn it. If they can feel my compassion and my love, they will start being compassionate and being loving. It is only in the milieu of love that one learns love. I'm just creating a climate here. It is not a teaching, it is a climate. And I don't have anything else to give. Whosoever comes, I can give my love and my compassion, because that is all that I have. And with us, I'm sick and tired of them. If you are sick and tired of them, then you are one of them. That very attitude of being sick and tired is violent. Why this question, such a long question, has arisen in Prigit's mind? And this is his first question, and he has been here for almost 2 years. Why such a long question has arisen? He has a very violent mind. He is a good group leader, but very violent one. He runs the gestalt and the bioenergetic groups. And he goes on beating people. And he had never asked this question up to now. But just few days before, one guy has beaten him really hard. Hence the question. If you are tired and sick of them, you are one of them. Feel compassion, feel love. Help people through love and compassion. And I know that sometimes you have to be hard too just because of compassion. That is another quality of hardness. Sometimes you have to push their buttons. But when you push their buttons, naturally, they can go to the extreme, they can hit you. A real group leader is always in danger. That is the risk. Because you provoke people to bring their negativities to the surface. And when those negativities come to the surface, naturally, you can be one of the targets. You are in danger. But a group leader will accept with gratitude. When somebody hits a group leader, he will bow down to him and say, "Thank you." Because that's what he wanted. He was creating a situation in which the anger bubbles up and bursts. Once that anger is gone, the men will have a totally different kind of energy. The group process is a catharsis. It is a process of taking out the pus of your system. But when you are taking pus off a system, sometimes few drops of pus may fall upon your clothes. That's natural. When you do surgery, your hands will be bloody. And you will need a good bath after it. Don't be angry, otherwise you become part of them. Now, Brigid wants, "I don't want to lead any groups, nor I want to rule people. Maybe I could work in the garden." No, not at all. "I love my trees. The second question, "Beloved Bhagwan, in answering my question, you kept referring to me as she. So you have found me out. Even growing a beard, I could not deceive you. Only one small request. May I keep the Swami in front of my name? Sari Ma Anand Sucheta. I goofed again. Yes, it has happened. Just the other day, Swami Anand Sucheta has asked a question and I continue to refer him as C. Now there are two other Suchetas, both are C. One Sucheta is he, two Suchetas are C. They have also written questions to me. But the Swami who had asked the question has really understood the point of it. It was clearly there. Swami was written on the question. But for two reasons, I was goofing. One was that Anand Sucheta really has a heart of a woman. By growing a beard, it makes no difference. There is a biological he and she, and there is a psychological he and she. Sometimes when I am giving sannyas to a person, I have to think twice whether to call him Ma or Swami. Not to create embarrassing situation for you, I go on giving Swami and Ma according to your biological body. But sometimes it is so clear that to call this person Swami seems absolutely wrong. He has such a feminine heart, and his path is going to be love. He is so receptive. Just the other night, Pravah was there. Now he has a heart of a woman. A very big man physically, but a very, very soft, vulnerable heart of a woman. Very loving heart. His psychological being is free. And that is really more important, because my work is concerned not with your biology, but with your psychology. But I am happy that Anand Sucheta understood the point. He says, in answering my question, you kept referring to me as she, so you have found me out. Even growing a beard, I could not deceive you. Only one small request, may I keep the Swami in front of my name, that you can go on keeping. But go on knowing that you are feminine. And be joyous about it. Because my understanding is that the feminine mind is closer to God than the masculine mind. The masculine mind is the Western mind, and the feminine mind is the Eastern mind. The masculine mind is aggressive, and the feminine mind is receptive. And God comes easily to them who can receive Him, like a womb. Who can become pregnant with God? You go on keeping your Swami name. That is for others. But for your own, you go on remembering. Become more and more feminine. Allow your femininity to take possession of you. Secondly, although Swami Anand Sucheta had asked the question, but the question was more relevant to one of the Ma Anand Suchetas. She had not asked it, but really she should have asked it. It was more relevant. So when sometimes I goof for reasons. Try to find out, meditate over. When I make a mistake, meditate over it. And you will always be enriched by it. The third question, Bhagwan, every time you come and go in the lecture, I am worried you may miss a step and fall. P.S. You look so drunk. That's true. But I have been so long drunk that you need not be afraid. For 25 years I have been that way. In the beginning it was really difficult to walk. I was myself very much afraid that I may fall any moment. Somehow, The body has become so distant, and there was such a gap. Earth and sky apart. It took time for me to settle back. Although everything has settled back, but the drunkenness is there. This is God drunkenness. Once you have drunken from the spring of the divine, you are never in a state of being undrunk. Once is enough. A drop of it is enough to drown you forever. You need not drink again and again. You never become thirsty. So, I can understand your question, but don't be worried. Somehow, I call it somehow, because I am not managing it. I cannot manage it, because I am not there to manage it. But it has managed itself. Somehow, I remain drunk and I remain aware. Sufis have a particular principle about it. It will be meaningful to understand it. They call it the oscillation between the two states. Ahwals. The two states are baka and fana, individuality and dissolution of the individuality. Between these two, there has to be a kind of rhythm, a synchronicity. There are people who are in their baka. But they don't know anything about fana. Then there are people who are in their fana, but they forget how to come back to baka. Both are lopsided. There is needed a kind of balance between the two, drunkenness and awareness. One has to be drunkenly aware, or alertly drunk. That is the highest alchemy, where opposites meet and become one. That is the greatest synthesis. It is said of Al-Junayd, master of Al-Hilal Mansur, that he used to impose discipline to establish a rhythm between these two polarities. It is reported that the master once ordered a disciple, Al-Sibli. Al-Sibli later on became a great master himself. This man, Al-Junayd, created many masters. He had a great creative energy to create masters. He was one of the masters of masters. When Al-Sibli attained his satori, his samadhi, his fana, he became incapable to come back to the baka. He was so drunk, so lost, that the master was very angry with him. He said, "You listen, Sibli. First you were clinging to your baka state. Now you have moved to the other, but you cling to the other. Clinging remains. Clinging has to go. One has to be more liquid. One has to be capable of moving from one to the other. Easily, smoothly, just like a pendulum that swings from left to right, right to left, without any hitch, hesitation, without any clinging. One has to attain to that smooth movement. But Al-Sidli could not follow. Then the master said, then it is better. You admit yourself into a mad asylum. For a time, if your self-discipline is not sufficient to restrain your mystic state's ahwal. This is a strange advice from a master. That you go to a madhouse and admit yourself into the madhouse till you attain a discipline where you can be alert and drunk together. This has been one of the greatest problems on the path of the ultimate ecstasy. And you will find this phenomenon in many ways. You see Buddha. Buddha is drunk and alert together. Ramakrishna is not alert. He is drunk. Something of the balance is missing. If you ask me, I cannot say you to make Ramakrishna the goal. When Ramakrishna will get into his sama state for days, he will remain almost unconscious. Once he remained for 6 days unconscious, in a coma. And whenever he will come out of it, he will start crying. And he will start asking God, take me back. Let me go into that again. He became like a child. It is good than the state of Baka. This ecstasy is good. But there is a higher stage to this. That is Buddha's state. He is drunk and yet alert. One has never seen him unconscious. He has managed the ultimate synthesis. The way of ecstasy is also the way of sobriety, because it is the science of knowledge of states. As Sheikh Ibn Ajiba has said, a drunkenness with consciousness of the state is higher than drunkenness with forgetfulness. Ecstasy is not the goal but the means, nevertheless an absolutely essential means. So you need not be afraid. I am drunk and alert together. My drunkenness takes care so I don't become too much alert that I am fixed in the baka. My awareness takes care so that I don't become fixed in the state of fana. They help each other like two wings of a bird. Opposites and yet complementary. With one wing you cannot fly. You will need both the wings. And that's my teaching. My whole effort here is to make you alert and drunk together. Hence, I go on telling you to dance and abandon yourself into dance and go on teaching you ways of meditation, awareness, vipassana, so that both can grow together. The day you are drunk, suddenly you will find a light burning in you which keeps you alert. And certainly, as Ajiba says, a drunkenness with awareness is higher than a drunkenness with forgetfulness. The fourth question, during the day, when I am bouncing around, I completely lose myself. I am enjoying, but where does meditation come in? The very enjoyment is what meditation is all about. The question is from Vidya. Now she is hankering for some misery. She is enjoying, but she cannot enjoy enjoying. She wants to create some trouble for herself. It is very difficult to be really happy and happy with happiness. Once you are happy, you start looking for some trouble. You cannot believe that you can be happy, you can really be happy, something must be wrong. Miserable, you are perfectly happy. That's your state, you know it. You are well acquainted with it. That is your identity. Miserable, you are happy because you know that this is how you are. But when you are happy, then you start becoming miserable. You cannot trust happiness. It is so unknown. Now that's what meditation is, to enjoy, to celebrate. Hoping to develop his son's character, a father once gave him a penny and a quarter as he was leaving for Sunday school. Now, Peter, you put whichever one you want in the offering plate, he said. When the boy returned, his father asked which coin he had given. Peter answered, well, just before they sent around the plate, the preacher said, the Lord loveth a cheerful giver, and I knew I could give the penny a lot more cheerfully than I could give the quarter, so I gave it. I perfectly agree with the boy. Whatsoever is cheerful, is good. Whatever makes you cheerful is religious. Let cheerfulness be your only religion, the only law. Let there be no other law. Just enjoy and enjoy tremendously, totally. Meditation will come like a shadow. It is meditation coming. It is the sound of the footsteps of meditation coming to you. The fifth question. It is a long, long journey between the preparation and the ultimate, between the state of robopathology and enlightenment, must one suffer during the period of the journey, or is there a possibility of peace? Please explain. It depends on you. It depends what attitude you take about it. Waiting can become great joy. If you trust that it is going to happen, if you trust that it is coming closer every moment, if you trust that it has already started happening because you have started moving towards it, then each moment that passes will make you more and more joyous. The home is coming closer. But you can be very miserable if you take the attitude that how long I have to wait? How far is the goal? Why I am to wait so long? Why others have reached? Why others are reaching before me? Then you can create 1001 problems for yourself and you can get miserable. And remember the lies, the more miserable you get in your waiting, the longer will be the waiting. Because God cannot happen in a miserable mind. The happier the waiting, closer you are coming. If your waiting can be your total joy, this very moment God will happen. No time gap is needed. It all depends on your patience. But when I say patience, I don't mean a negative quality. I mean a joyous patience. Thrilled, expectant. It is going to happen. Whenever it is going to happen, that is not the point. It is going to happen. All depends how you interpret. Interpretation is a process that has to be understood very deeply. You can see a rose bush and you can start counting the thorns. And if you count the thorns, there are millions. And in that very counting, you will become incapable of seeing the rose. Counting the thorns, being hurt by the thorns, your hands will be bloody, you will be angry, you will be frustrated, you will be in despair, and your eyes will not be capable to see the rose. How can you see the rose with so many thorns? In your eyes, thorns will be floating. Your eyes will be covered by thorns. You will not be able to see the rose. Even if you can have a glimpse of the rose, you will not be able to trust how the rose can happen. You know only thorns. You know the pain of the thorns. The rose seems to be an impossibility. Maybe it is a dream. Maybe you have imagined. It is a hallucination or something. But in the very nature of things, it cannot happen. It is so contrary to the experience of thorns. And then it becomes impossible. By and by, you will become oblivious of the rose. Then it no more exists for you. But if you look at the rose, you feel the rose, you become rosy with the rose, you allow the fragrance to move into your innermost core, you feel the wetness of the flower, the dewdrops on it, the sun rays dancing, you see the utter joy of the flower, the incomparable beauty of it. In that very vision of the rose, thorns start receding back. They may be in the bush, but they don't exist for you. They can't exist for you. Your eyes are full of rose. And when your eyes are really full of rose, not only your eyes, but your heart too, then you will be surprised that thorns don't matter. Even if there are 10,000 thorns for one rose, only rose matters. Thorns don't matter. Your whole outlook has changed. And you will look at thorns with a new vision. You will see the thorns not as enemies of the rose, but as bodyguards of the rose. They are guarding. They are friends. They protect. Otherwise the rose is so delicate it will not be possible. Those thorns are a must. Once you have started seeing the beauty of life, ugliness starts disappearing. It becomes at the most a shadow. If you start looking at life with joy, sadness starts disappearing. You cannot have both heaven and hell together. You can have only one. It is your choice. And you can have it any moment. If you want the hell, you can have it right now. If you want the heaven, you can have that too. It is absolutely your responsibility. It is your choice. It depends how you interpret. I would like to say a few anecdotes to you. 30 nuns arrived in purgatory. Now girls, said the angel in charge, I want every one of you who ever was sexually involved in any kind of relationship on the earth to stand up. And remember, no fibbing. I have ways of checking up on you. Seriously, 29 of the nuns stood up. But the 30th remained seated. The angel nodded and put in a phone call to the devil. Satan, he said, I am sending down 30 nuns to you. And I advise you to be particularly careful of one. She is stone deaf. Now, this is your interpretation. This shows more the mind of the angel than anything about the woman who has kept silent and has not stood up. Another scene. The pearly gates. St. Peter interviewing a new arrival. St. Peter, name, new arrival, Melvin. St. Peter, did you ever gamble, drink or smoke when you were on the earth? Melvin, no. St. Peter, did you ever steal, lie, cheat or swear? Melvin, no. St. Peter, were you promiscuous? Melvin, no. St. Peter, tell me, what kept you so long there? This shows the mind of St. Peter. Nothing about Melvin. The third. Rabbi Jacobs, I need $50 to get out of debt. Sabd Gottlieb, I keep praying to God to help, but he has not sent it. Don't lose faith, said the rabbi. Keep praying. After Gottlieb left his house, the rabbi felt sorry for him. I don't make much money, he thought, but that poor man needs it. I will give him $25 out of my own pocket. A week later, the rabbi stopped Gottlieb and said, here, God sent this to you. Back in his home, Gottlieb bowed his head. Thank you, Lord, he said, but next time you send money, don't send it through Rabbi Jacob. That crook kept half of it. It all depends on you, how you look at things. You can see each day surrounded by two nights, or you can see each night surrounded by two days. And it really makes a lot of difference. Let your waiting be joyous. You are waiting for God. Let it be a song in your heart. Let it be prayerful. Let it be a celebration. Only celebration is sacred. Just the other day I was reading one statement of a German philosopher, Martin Heidegger. He says that I have not come across anything in the world which can be called sacred. Now this man must have lived a very poor life. Utterly poor life. If he cannot say and he cannot watch for and cannot be a witness for a single thing that he can call sacred, his life must have been of utter frustration. He has not known any sun. He has not known any joy. He has not seen a smile on a child's face. He has not seen tears. He has not heard to the birds singing. And he has not seen roses and lotuses flowering. And he has not looked at the stars. He has missed. The whole life is sacred. Once it happens, Buddha asked one of his disciples, that can you find anything which is worthless in life, then bring it. The disciples thought for many days, and Buddha inquired every day, what is happening? Have you not yet found anything worthless? And after a month or two, the disciple came and he said, sorry, I looked all around. I looked very hard. I could not sleep because you had put a question and I had to find the answer. But I could not find anything worthless. Then Buddha said, now another task. Find anything which has worth. How many days you will take for it? Because months you took for the first. And the disciple laughed. He said, no need to take any time. Just he takes the istra from the ground and gives it to Buddha. And he says, this is enough a proof. This has worth. Buddha blessed the disciple and he said, this is how one should look at life. This is the right attitude. Samyak drashti, right vision. Said Buddha, I am happy with you. That you took months and still you could not find anything worthless. And you need not you could not find a single instance of something meaningless. And now, for the meaningful, for that which has worth, you have not taken a single second even. Yes, this is how it is. The whole life is sacred. Buddha has lived a rich life, spiritually rich. Heidegger must have lived in misery. How can you say that life has nothing as sacred in it? Each moment of it is sacred. But you need the eyes to see that sacredness. God is not missing from existence. Only your vision is not yet tuned for it. You ask, it is long, long journey between the preparation and the ultimate. That length of the journey depends on you. It can be long, very long. It may not be so long. It may be very short. The goal depends on you. How long is not a fixed phenomenon. It is not that it can be measured. It becomes long if you look through misery, anguish, anxiety, antagonism. If your eyes are full of sadness, you create the long distance. If your eyes are full of joy, it is here, it is now, it is this. The seventh question, Bhagwan, you are so crazy. How does it feel to be totally crazy? Just far out. And the last question. Beloved Master, has it happened? Has it finally happened? Is that you inside my heart, so clear and constantly with me now? Yes, Divya, it has happened. But don't grab it, otherwise it can disappear again. Let it be there, but don't become greedy. Otherwise, out of your greed, you can crush it. Let it be there, but don't take it for granted. The moment you take it for granted, it disappears. It is there. It has happened. It is going to happen to all, as it has happened to you. But remember, it is very fragile. It is very subtle. You cannot keep it in a fist. The moment you close, you kill it. If you remain open, it will be there. And never expect it to be there, and it will be there. And if you start expecting, then you create hindrances. Yes, it has happened. But now, you will have to be more alert not to destroy it. It is not so hard. When it has not happened, it is not so hard. The work is not so hard. The real work starts when it starts happening. Because then you have to be very, very careful and very conscious. A single moment of unconsciousness and you can destroy it. Enough for today.